other than material self-interest. Watching liberals express bewilderment that they seem to be acting against their own self-interest by not accepting a few material scraps they are offered by Democratic candidates presumably only makes matters worse. The trap from the perspective of the Republican Party is that by playing to white working class populism in this way, they forever forego the possibility of stripping away any significant portion of the Democratic Party's core support, African Americans, Latinos, immigrants, and second-generation children of immigrants, for whom, despite the fact that they are also overwhelmingly believing Christians, and despite the fact that their children are so strongly overrepresented in the armed forces, this kind of anti-intellectual politics is simply anathema. Could one seriously imagine an African-American politician successfully playing the anti-intellectual card in the manner of George W. Bush? Such a thing would be unthinkable. The core Democratic constituencies are precisely those who not only have a more vivid sense of themselves as bearers of a culture and community, but crucially, for whom education is still a value in itself. Hence, the deadlock of American politics. Now, think of all the women, mostly white women, who posted their stories to the We Are the 99% page. From this vantage, it's hard to see them as expressing anything but an analogous protest against the cynicism of our political culture, even if it takes the form of the absolute minimum demand to pursue a life dedicated to helping, teaching, or caring for others without having to sacrifice the ability to take care of their own families. Footnote. Sylvia Federici, in a little essay called Women, Austerity, and the Unfinished Feminist Revolution, in Occupy, number 3, N plus 1, November 2011, pages 32-34, moves in a similar direction when she makes the point that mainstream feminism has gone astray in placing all its emphasis on guaranteeing women's participation in the labor market, seeing this as intrinsically liberating rather than the domain of what she, using a somewhat ungainly Marxist phrase, calls the sphere of reproduction. Continuing, and, after all, is support our school teachers and nurses any less legitimate a cry than support our troops? And is it a coincidence that so many actual former soldiers, veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have found themselves drawn to their local occupations? By gathering together in the full sight of Wall Street and creating a community without money based on principles not just of democracy, but of mutual caring, solidarity, and support, occupiers were proposing a revolutionary challenge not just to the power of money, but to the power of money to determine what life itself was supposed to be about. It was the ultimate blow not just against Wall Street, but against that very principle of cynicism, of which it was the ultimate embodiment. At least for that brief moment, love had become the ultimate revolutionary act. Not surprising, then, that the guardians of the existing order identified it for what it was, and reacted as if they were facing a military provocation. Question 7. Why did the movement appear to collapse so quickly after the camps were evicted in November 2011? Pretty much the moment the camps were evicted in November 2011, the media began reporting on Occupy's demise. According to the narrative that soon became established in the U.S. media, things were already beginning to fall apart even before the evictions. Supposedly, what had once been idealistic experiments began to fill with criminals, addicts, and homeless and crazy people. Hygienic standards broke down. There was an epidemic of sexual assault. The famous photograph of the homeless derelict with his pants down, apparently preparing to relieve his bowels in a NYPD police car near Zuccotti Park, became the counter-image to the famous Tony Bologna pepper spray video and was widely held out as an icon of just how low things were descending. The fact that there's no evidence the person in question even was an occupier was treated as immaterial. Most of these claims dissolve away the moment one examines them. For instance, despite claims of an epidemic of rape, the total number of occupiers accused of sexual assault among hundreds of occupations appears to have been exactly two. As Rebecca Solnit has pointed out, the United States has the highest rate of sexual assault against women of any country in the world, and the media hardly sees this as a moral crisis. Yet somehow, the news story in Occupy was not that activists had managed to create an environment in the middle of the most dangerous American cities where the rate of assault against women had clearly precipitously declined, but a scandal that they had not eliminated such incidents altogether. What's more, as she goes on to report of Oakland, California, now here's something astonishing. While the camp was in existence, crime went down 19% in Oakland, a statistic the city was careful to conceal. It may be counter to our statement that the Occupy movement is negatively impacting crime in Oakland. The police chief wrote to the mayor in an email that local news stations KTVU later obtained and released to little fanfare. Pay attention. Occupy was so powerful a force for nonviolence that it was already solving Oakland's chronic crime and violence problems just by giving people hope and meals and solidarity and conversation. Needless to say, no newspaper headlines loudly proclaiming violent crime dropped sharply during occupation ever appeared, and police continued to insist, despite the evidence of their own statistics, that exactly the opposite was the case. Insofar as some camps did begin having internal troubles, it was not because of a lack of police. In fact, all were surrounded by police 24/7, so in theory, they should have been the safest places in America. But precisely because police did everything in their power to bring it about, many of the homeless ex-convicts who ended up settling in Zuccotti Park, for instance, reported having been actually bused to the location on release from Rikers Island by officers who told them that free food and lodging were available in the park. This is a common tactic. In Greece, just about everyone I talked to who had been involved in the General Assembly at Syntagma Square told stories of pickpockets and drug dealers who'd been informed by the police that they would not be prosecuted for carrying out their trade among the protesters. In any way, the remarkable thing is that, under such pressures, most camps did remain relatively safe spaces and did not break down into the kind of Habesian chaos that the media and municipal authorities invariably claim they were. What was really happening here? First of all, I think we have to understand that what happened did not occur in isolation. It has to be understood in its global context. Occupy is, as I've repeatedly stressed, simply the North American manifestation of a democratic rebellion that began in Tunisia in January 2011, and by the end of that year was threatening to call into question existing structures of power everywhere. One could hardly imagine that existing structures of power would fail to be concerned by these developments or try to contain the danger to the established order, and clearly they did not fail to do so. In fact, the United States is the center of a whole apparatus of political, administrative, and security mechanisms that have put in place over the last generations largely to contain precisely this sort of danger, to ensure that popular uprisings like these either do not occur or at least do not make much difference and are quickly demobilized. In the Middle East, the United States performed a complex balancing act, allowing some democratic movements to be violently suppressed, Bahrain is the most famous example, and attempting to co-opt or neutralize others through aid and NGOs. In Europe, this was a series of what can only be called financial coups, with the political elite of the wealthy northern countries effectively ousting elected governments in Greece and Italy and imposing neutral technocrats to push through austerity budgets, accompanied by increasingly sophisticated police operations against those gathered in their public squares. In the United States, after 2 months of hesitation, police began systematically clearing the encampments, often using overwhelming militarized force, and even more crucially made it clear to occupiers that from that time on, any group of citizens who intended to recreate encampments anywhere would be subject to immediate physical attack. The U.S. government line has always been that none of this was coordinated. we are supposed to believe that somehow hundreds of municipal authorities all independently decided to evict their local camps using the same pretext, sanitation, employing the same tactics all at the same time, and that all of them likewise decided that no camp would be set up after that. Even if occupiers attempted to do so completely legally, this is of course absurd. Efforts to suppress the global justice movement back in 1999, 2000, and 2001 were clearly coordinated, and since September 11, 2001, the government has added several layers of new security bureaucracy with the express purpose of coordinating responses to anything perceived as a threat to public order. If those running such institutions were really just sitting back and paying no attention to the sudden appearance of a large, rapidly growing, and potentially revolutionary nationwide movement, they weren't doing their jobs. How did they proceed? Well, again, we don't know, and presumably won't know for many years to come. It took us decades to learn the exact nature of FBI efforts to subvert the civil rights and peace movements in the 1960s. Still, the broad outlines of what have happened are not particularly hard to reconstruct. Actually, there's a fairly standard playbook employed by pretty much any government attempting to suppress a democratic movement, and this one clearly went very much beyond, or went much by the book. Here's how it goes. First, you try to destroy the moral authority of the radicals who actually drive the movement by painting them as contemptible and, at least potentially, violent. Then you try to peel off their middle-class allies with a combination of calculated concessions and scare stories. Or even, if a genuinely revolutionary situation seems imminent, the intentional creation of public disorder. This is what Mubarak's government so famously did in Egypt when they began releasing hardened criminals from prison and withdrawing police protection from middle-class neighborhoods to convince residents that the revolution could only lead to chaos. Then you attack. Back in 2000, I spent a good deal of time documenting how this first stage worked in the wake of the WTO protests in Seattle. At the time, I was often working with activist media liaisons, and we would have to deal with bursts of bizarre claims that always seemed to suddenly appear on the horizon, clearly deriving from multiple official sources, all at the same time. During the summer of 2000, for example, there was one week where suddenly everyone started saying that anti-globalization protests were all actually rich kids with trust funds. Shortly thereafter, we began to hear a list of ultra-violent forms of behavior that protesters were supposed to have employed in Seattle. Use of slingshots, throwing of Molotovs, rocks and excrement, water guns full of urine, bleach or acid, the use of crowbars to rip up sidewalks, to secure projectiles to throw at police. Warnings about such violent tactics soon began regularly appearing in the newspapers before trade summits, often on the authority of experts sent to drill the local police, creating a mood of looming panic. Despite the fact that, during the Seattle protests themselves, no one even suggested anyone had done anything of the sort, when such stories appeared in the New York Times, members of the local Direct Action Network, myself included, actually picketed the paper, and was forced to issue a retraction after calling the Seattle police, who confirmed that they had no evidence any of these tactics had actually been deployed. Yet, the stories kept appearing anyway. While there's no way to know precisely what was happening, the bits of evidence we could glean suggested they traced back to some sort of a network of private security companies that worked in liaison with police, right-wing think tanks, and possibly some sorts of police intelligence units. Before long, police chiefs in cities facing mobilization started making up similar stories, which would invariably make splashy headlines for a few days, until we managed to establish the violent acts had never happened, by which time, of course, the entire subject was no longer considered newsworthy. When you look at such smears in historical perspective, certain unmistakable patterns begin to emerge. The most dramatic is the juxtaposition, constant juxtaposition, of human body waste and men in uniform. I'm not sure I've ever seen a police slander against democracy protesters that did not contain at least one reference to someone hurling or preparing to hurl excrement. Presumably, it all goes back to the success of the image of 1960s protesters spitting on returning veterans, one that lodged firmly in the popular imagination, despite there being no evidence it actually happened. But even by the 1970s, lurid visions of hippies throwing shit had become a staple of the right-wing media, and always seemed to reappear right before the men and women in uniform are ordered to attack peaceful protesters. Always, of course, without the slightest bit of documentary evidence. Videographers have caught thousands of images of police beating occupiers, journalists, and random passersby. No one has ever caught an image of an occupier hurling dung. The emphasis on excrement is so effective because psychologically it serves two purposes. The first is to win over the hearts and minds of the lower-ranking police officers who will actually be asked to swing the billy clubs against nonviolent idealist heads. Footnote. As I've written in the past, claiming that globalization protesters were really so many trust fund babies was perfectly calibrated to achieve the desired effect. It was a way of saying, don't think of what you are doing in defending this trade summit as a matter of protecting a bunch of fat cats who have contempt for you and everything like you, everything and everyone like you. Think of it rather as an opportunity to beat up on their bratty children, but don't actually kill any of them because you never know who their parents might be. Continuing. And who, in the early days of Occupy, were often quite sympathetic on an individual basis. By January and February, when the repression had really become systematic, activists who had the opportunity to have long conversations with their arresting officers found it was impossible to convince them that occupiers had not been regularly pelting public employees with excrement. The second effect is, of course, to destroy the moral authority of the activist in the eyes of the public, to paint them as both contemptible and violent. The photo of the homeless man squatting next to the police car seemed to service the first purpose quite handily. The problem with the second was, in New York in particular, there was simply no way to make a plausible claim that activists were attacking the police. So instead the line became, the police were obliged to step in to prevent activists from being violent to one another. Really, this was simply an extension of a symbolic strategy that appeared to have been hatched in the very early weeks of the movement, when local authorities were struggling over how to come up with a pretext for criminalizing often largely middle-class citizens engaged in setting up tents. How could one really justify sending in heavily armed riot police against citizens who are mostly not even breaking any laws, but merely violating certain municipal camping regulations? From the beginning, the solution was clear. Sanitation. The camps were to be identified with filth. The presence of often very meticulous sanitation working groups were, of course, considered irrelevant in this respect. Already in the second or third week of occupation, activists in cities as far apart as Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, were being informed that since the city was concerned about hygienic conditions, the camps would have to be completely cleared each day for special cleaning. A cleaning that then turned out to take 4 or 5 hours every day. From den to filth, it was easy enough to carry over the imagery to cesspool of violence, crime, and degradation. And of course, when the camps were evicted, though mayors generally justified their actions by the need to protect everyone, including the campers, from crime, the official reason was in almost every case the need to provide access to public sanitation crews. None of this directly answers the question of why the movement seemed to shrivel up so rapidly after the evictions, but it provides the necessary context. The first thing to emphasize here is that we are talking about appearances. To say a movement seemed to shrivel up is not to say that it actually did. There is no doubt that the attacks on the camps, the destruction of occupiers' homes, kitchens, clinics, and libraries, the consequent creation in many cities of a refugee population of activists, many of whom had given up their jobs and homes to join the camps, and who suddenly found themselves on the streets or taking shelter in church basements, many traumatized, dealing with psychological consequences of arrest, injury, imprisonment, and the loss of most of their worldly possessions, was sure to have its effects. At first, The movement was thrown into enormous disarray. Recriminations abounded. Indignation over issues of race, class, and gender that had largely been put aside during the heady days of the occupation seemed to emerge all at once. Everyone suddenly seemed to start fighting over money. In New York, more than $500,000 had poured in. Within a few months, it had all been spent providing accommodation and transport money. The churches charged us for the hundreds who had been displaced. Some of the organizational forms, like the General Assembly, that had worked so beautifully in the camps, proved entirely unsuited for the new situation. In most cities, GAs largely fell apart over the winter, though usually large working groups with some immediate practical purpose. In New York, the Direct Action Working Group and various specific assemblies convoked to work on specific projects like the May Day mobilization ended up doing most of the same work. In retrospect, the collapse of the General Assembly model was hardly surprising. Most of us who had experience in the global justice movement considered the idea something of a crazy experiment from the outset. We'd always assumed that for meetings of any real size, certainly any meeting involving thousands of people, the consensus process would only work if we adopted some kind of spokes council model, where everyone was arranged into groups with temporary spokes, who alone could make proposals and participate in discussion, though this was always balanced by breakouts into smaller groups where everyone could tell their spokes what to say, or even replace them. The spokes council model had worked quite well during the mass mobilizations of 1999 through 2003. The remarkable thing about the GA approach was that it ever worked at all, which it did, when there was an actual face-to-face community to be maintained. None of us were particularly surprised when, as soon as the camps were cleared, the GAs fell apart. Footnote: the tragedy of New York, at least, was that while a spokes council model was introduced, it was brought in what was widely seen as a top-down, divisive way at a moment of maximum conflict. There are currently efforts underway in New York to revive a spokes council model in a more democratic fashion. Continuing, what really slowed things down and led so many to believe the movement was collapsing was an unhappy concatenation of several factors. The sudden change in police tactics, which made it impossible for activists to create any sort of free public space in an American city without being immediately physically assaulted. The abandonment by our liberal allies, who made no effort to make a public issue of this new policy, and a sudden media blackout, which ensured most Americans had no idea this was even happening. Maintaining a public space like Zuccotti Park was full of problems, and by the end, many organizers actually said they were a bit relieved that they no longer had to spend all their time worrying about the equivalent of zoning issues, and could start concentrating on planning direct actions and real political campaigns. They soon discovered that without a single center, one where anyone interested in the movement knew they could go at any time to get involved, express support, or just find out what's happening, this became much more difficult to do. But attempts to reestablish such a center were systematically stymied. An effort to convince Trinity Church, an erstwhile ally in Lower Manhattan, to let occupiers use a large deserted lot it was holding as a real estate investment failed. After appeals, even from the likes of Desmond Tutu fell on deaf ears, several Episcopal bishops led a march to peacefully occupy the space. They were immediately arrested, and somehow, the entire story of their involvement never made it into the news. On the 6-month anniversary of the original occupation, on March 17th, former occupiers threw an impromptu party in Zuccotti Park. After about an hour, police attacked, which left several activists seriously injured and in the hospital. One band broke off and set up sleeping bags in Union Square, while a public park had traditionally always remained open 24 hours a day. Within a few days, the tables began to appear around them with Occupy literature, and a kitchen and library began to be set up. The city responded by declaring that from now on, the park would close at midnight, leading to what came to be called the nightly eviction theater, as hundreds of riot police were assembled at 11 every evening to drive out the handful of campers with their sleeping bags at midnight. No camping regulations were enforced so aggressively that activists were arrested for placing blankets over themselves or, in one case I myself witnessed, wrestled to the pavement and shackled for bending down to a pet dog. The police commander explained that in doing so, the protester was too close to the ground. During this period, the level of violence involved in arrests increased dramatically. Even during the most peaceful protests, marchers who strayed off the sidewalk, or even seemed like they might be about to, found themselves tackled and having their heads repeatedly smashed against the concrete. Police began deploying new, exotic tactics of intimidation, some of which appear to have been imported from abroad. For instance, in Egypt, when some revolutionaries attempted a renewed occupation of Tahrir Square in November and December 2011, police responded by a systematic campaign of sexual assault against female protesters. Female arrestees were not only beaten, but stripped and groped, often ostentatiously in front of their male counterparts. Egyptian friends told me the aim seemed twofold: to maximally traumatize women activists, but also to provoke male activists to violence in their defense. Similarly, when attempts at reoccupation in New York began in March, we saw a sudden, intense spate of police sexual attacks on women protesters, something that had happened, at best, only very occasionally before. I met one woman who told me five different police had grabbed her breast during one evening's eviction from Union Square, on one occasion, while another officer stood by blowing kisses. Another screamed and called the policeman fondling her a pervert, whereupon he and his fellow officers dragged her behind police lines and broke her wrists. Yet, even when one well-known Occupy spokeswoman appeared on Democracy Now, displaying a large, hand-shaped bruise across her chest, the media simply refused to pick up the story. Rather, the new rules of engagement, that anyone showing up at a large protest, however peaceful, should just understand that this might mean being arrested or put in the hospital, were simply treated as a kind of new normal, and any particular instance of police violence as no longer newsworthy. Media sources did, dutifully, report the dwindling numbers who showed up to such marches, which for obvious reasons soon came to consist principally of hardcore activists willing to accept beatings and imprisonment, now almost entirely bereft of the flocks of children and old people who had accompanied and so humanized our earlier actions. While reporting the decreasing numbers at marches, the media refused to report the reasons why. So the real question is, how did these rules change, and why was the effective repeal of the First Amendment, at least as it applies to freedom of assembly, simply allowed to stand uncontested? As every experienced activist knows, the rules of engagement on the streets have everything to do with quality and effectiveness of one's alliances. One reason Occupy got so much attention in the media at first, most of the seasoned activists I talked to agreed that we had never seen anything like it, was that so many more mainstream activist groups so quickly endorsed our cause. I am referring here particularly to those organizations that might be said to define the left wing of the Democratic Party, MoveOn.org, for example, or Rebuild the Dream. Such groups were enormously energized by the birth of Occupy. But, as I touched on above, most also seem to have assumed that the principled rejection of electoral politics and top-down forms of organization was simply a passing phase. The childhood of a movement that, they assumed, would mature into something resembling a left-wing Tea Party. From their perspective, the camp soon became a distraction. The real business of the movement would begin once Occupy became a conduit for guiding young activists into legislative campaigns and eventually get out the vote drives for progressive candidates. It took some time for them to fully realize that the core of the movement was serious about its principles. It's also fairly clear that when the camps were cleared, not only such groups, but the liberal establishment more generally, made a strategic decision to look the other way. From the perspective of the radicals, this was the ultimate betrayal. We had made our commitment to horizontal principles clear from the outset. They were the essence of what we were trying to do. But at the same time, we understood that there has always been a tacit understanding in America between radical groups like ourselves and their liberal allies. The radicals' call for revolutionary change creates a fire to the liberals' left that makes the liberals' own proposals for reform seem a more reasonable alternative. We win them a place at the table. They keep us out of jail. In these terms, the liberal establishment utterly failed to live up to their side of the bargain. Occupy succeeded brilliantly in changing the national debate to begin addressing issues of financial power, the corruption of the political process, and social inequality, all to the benefit of the liberal establishment, which had struggled to gain traction around these issues. But when the tasers, batons, and SWAT teams arrived, that establishment simply disappeared and left us to our fate. This might seem inevitable in retrospect, but it's not the way things have tended to work in the past. Obviously, the violent suppression of social movements is hardly new. One need only think of the Red Scare, the reaction to radical labor movements like the IWW, let alone the campaigns of outright assassination directed against the American Indian Movement or black radicals in the 1960s and early 1970s, but in almost every case, the victims were either working class or non-white. On the few occasions where even much milder systematic repression is directed at any significant number of middle-class white people, as during the McCarthy era, or against student protesters during the Vietnam War, it quickly becomes a national scandal. And, while it would be wrong to call Occupy Wall Street a middle-class white people's movement, it was much more diverse than that. There is no doubt that very large numbers of middle-class white people were involved in it. Yet, the government did not hesitate to attack it, often using highly militarized tactics, often deploying what can only be called terroristic violence, that is, if terrorism is defined as attacks on civilians consciously calculated to create terror for political ends. I know this statement might seem controversial, but when Los Angeles police, for example, opened fire with rubber bullets on a group of chalk-wielding protesters engaged in a perfectly legal, permitted art walk in an obvious attempt to teach citizens that participating in an Occupy-related activity could lead to physical injury, it's hard to see how that word should not apply. What had changed? One answer is that this was the first American social movement to emerge since 9/11. Did the war on terror really change the rules? I must admit that when we first began the occupation, I was somewhat surprised that the emotional aftermath of 9/11 wasn't something we had to deal with. Zuccotti Park might have been two blocks away from Wall Street, but it was also two blocks away from Ground Zero, and I remember anticipating all sorts of charges of sacrilege and disrespect for the victims of terrorist attacks. These never materialized, but as we were ultimately to discover, 9/11 changed the ground we were working on in other, much more subtle ways. Yes, there was a brief window where the Gandhian formula, delegitimating power by maintaining scrupulous nonviolence, and then allowing the world to witness just how brutal the state's reaction would nonetheless be, did actually seem to work, but it was very brief. It's not enough to note that, after the evictions, liberal organizations seem to have made a strategic decision not to make an issue of the violence. One also has to ask why they could get away with it, why their constituents were not sufficiently shocked by the violence to demand some sort of accounting. It's here where I think the real psychological effects of 9/11 can be seen. The immediate wake of the terrorist attack saw a major militarization of the American police. Billions were allocated to providing anti-terrorist equipment and training to police departments in otherwise underfunded municipalities like Dayton, Ohio, that clearly did not face terrorist threats of any kind. This helps explain that the sometimes bizarre overreaction to many of our actions, as when a few dozen activists attempted to occupy a foreclosed home in New Jersey, or when we attempted to make our speeches on the steps of Federal Hall in Manhattan and were greeted by heavily armed SWAT teams. In another age, such overkill would have provoked outrage. In 2012, it went completely unremarked. How did middle-class liberals become so accepting of the militarization of the police? Largely, by their absolute steadfast rejection of anything that might even suggest the possibility of violence on the part of protesters. even if police executed what was clearly a pre-planned assault on peaceful protesters, say by firing tear gas canisters directly at occupiers' heads, as did indeed happen several times in Oakland. The first response by both media and liberal commentators was always to ask whether any occupier, at any point, responded to that assault with anything other than passive resistance. Even if one person kicked a tear gas canister back in the cop's direction, the story would no longer be police opened fire on protesters or even Marine veteran in critical condition after being shot in the head by tear gas canister, but rather protesters engage in clashes with police. In one of the great ironies of history, the invocation of the spirit of Gandhi and Martin Luther King became the prime means of justifying the newfound militarization of American society, in a way that would surely have left either man, had they been alive to witness it, both astounded and horrified. Occupy is an extraordinarily nonviolent movement. It may well be the most nonviolent movement of its size in American history, and this despite the absence of peace codes, marshals, or official peace police. In the fall, there were at least 500 occupations, with participants representing remarkably diverse philosophies, from evangelical Christians to revolutionary anarchists, and thousands of marches and actions, and yet the most violent acts attributed to protesters were four or five acts of window breaking, basically less than one might expect in the wake of not particularly rowdy Canadian hockey game. Historically, this is an extraordinary achievement. Yet has it ever been treated as such? Instead, the handful of windows themselves become a moral crisis. In the immediate wake of the evictions, when Americans first had the opportunity to process the full extent of what had happened, the mass arrests, beatings, the systematic destruction of homes and libraries, the liberal blogosphere was instead almost completely dominated by arguments about a piece called The Cancer in Occupy, written by a former New York Times reporter turned OWS supporter named Chris Hedges, who argued that one or two incidents of window breaking in Oakland were actually the work of a violent and fanatical anarchist faction he called the Black Bloc, and that the most important thing the movement could do was to expose and exclude such elements lest they provide a pretext for police. The fact that almost no statement in the piece was factually accurate. Black blocs are in fact a formation, not a group, and probably 95% of occupations hadn't even seen one, only seemed to give everyone more excuse to argue about it. Before long, liberal commentators had formed a consensus that the real problem with Occupy was not any act of actual physical violence that had taken place, these had pretty much all been carried out by police, but the fact that some occupations contained some elements that, while they had not committed any acts of violence, felt that acts of damage to property could be justified. To give a sense of the disparity, even in New York in March, there was still endless discussion of a single cafe window that may or may not have been broken by an activist associated with a Black Bloc in Oakland during a march in November. As a result, there was virtually no discussion of the first OWS-associated window breaking in New York itself, which occurred on March 17th. The window in question, it was a shop window in Lower Manhattan, was broken by an NYPD officer using an activist's head. Just to give a sense how perverse this invocation of Gandhi to justify state violence really is, we might recall the words and actions of Gandhi himself. For most anarchists, Gandhi is an ambivalent figure. On the one hand, his philosophy drew heavily on the anarchism of Tolstoy and Kropotkin. On the other, he embraced a kind of masochistic puritanism and encouraged a cult of personality whose implications can only be profoundly inimical to the creation of a truly free society. He did condemn all forms of violence, but he also insisted that passive acquiescence to an unjust social order was even worse. I remember one conference on OWS at the New School in New York in the wake of the evictions, where liberal pacifists kept reminding organizers that Gandhi had gone so far as suspending his Quit India campaign when there was an incident of violence. What they didn't mention was that the incident in question involved Gandhi's own followers hacking 22 police officers to pieces and setting fire to the remains. It seems a pretty safe guess that if members of, say, Occupy Cleveland or Occupy Denver were discovered to have carved large numbers of police officers limb from limb, our movement would have stopped dead in its tracks as well, even without a charismatic leader to tell us to. In a world where such things were possible, the idea that Gandhi himself would have become worked up over a couple of broken windows is nothing short of insane. In fact, as a politician, Gandhi regularly resisted demands that he condemn those engaged in more militant forms of anti-colonial resistance, that is, when they were not part of his own movement. Even when it was a matter of guerrillas attacking police stations, blowing up trains, he would always note that while he believed nonviolence was the correct approach, these were good people trying to do what they believed to be the right thing. While opposing injustice nonviolently, he insisted, is always morally superior to opposing it violently, opposing injustice violently is still morally superior to doing nothing to oppose it at all. One could only wish those who claim to speak in the name of Gandhi would, occasionally, act like him. But, despite all of this, was the movement indeed stopped dead in its tracks? Absolutely not. We had a rough 6 or 8 months trying to find our footing in a radically new and much more physically hostile environment without the benefit of sympathetic press. There were dramatic new campaigns, Occupy foreclosed homes, Occupy farms, rent strikes, educational initiatives. There were endless trainings and new street tactics, and a newfound emphasis on drama and comedy, partly just to keep spirits up in the face of repression. But mainly, there was a search for new alliances. Once the liberals had largely abandoned us, the next step was to strengthen our ties with what we always considered our real allies, the unions, the community organizations, and immigrants' rights groups. In New York, Occupy's first really large initiative after the evictions was to take part in planning a nationwide May Day general strike. This was always a risky undertaking, since we all understood that we couldn't really organize a general strike in the traditional sense, and the media would almost certainly announce it was a failure. But having millions of people nationwide come out in the streets to create a forum for the development of new initiatives seemed like it would be victory enough. And while in New York, we did manage to convince the leadership of pretty much every union in the city, including the Teamsters and Central Labor Council, to endorse a call for revolutionary transformation, the final results were sobering. It turned out that union bureaucracies, in particular, are simply too vulnerable to pressure from above to make very effective allies. Just as in Bloombergville, union leaders talked enthusiastically about the idea of civil disobedience in the planning stages, then, at the last minute, balked. Ambitious plans to shut down the city gradually dissolved into a simple, permitted march to which the unions didn't even make much effort to turn out their rank and file for fear they'd be assaulted by the NYPD. By mid-May, most of the core organizers of Occupy Wall Street had come to the conclusion that it would be better to put aside the whole question of alliance building and think about our base. What were the issues that had the most direct appeal to the real daily problems of occupiers and to our friends and families? How could we organize campaigns that would take on those problems directly? We decided to organize a series of weekly open forums, each with a different theme: climate, change, debt, police, and prisons, to see which one took off. As it turned out, the debt forum was so enormously successful, it instantly put all others in the shadows. A series of debtor assemblies was quickly thrown together, each bringing together hundreds of participants, many new to the movement, bursting with projects and ideas. By the time of the writing, the emerging strike debt campaign, with campaigns with names like the Invisible Army, Rolling Jubilee, Debt Resistors Operations Manual, and People's Bailout, are clearly the most exciting growth areas of the movement. Occupy has returned to its roots. Of course, endless questions remain. Is it really possible to create a mass movement of debt resistance in America? How to overcome the feelings of shame and isolation the debt always seems to foster? Or, to put it in a different way, how to provide a base of democratic support and a public forum for those millions of Americans, 1 in 6, by some estimates, who are effectively already practicing civil disobedience against financial capitalism by refusing to pay their debts. It isn't obvious. For all we know, by the time this book appears, some new campaign will have emerged from some other city that will ultimately prove even more inspiring. In social movement terms, a single year is nothing. Movements that aim for immediate legislative goals tend to flicker quickly in and out of existence. In America, movements that have successfully aimed for a broad moral transformation of society, from the abolitionists to feminism, have taken much longer to see concrete results. But when they do, those results are deep and abiding. In 1 year, Occupy managed to both identify the problem, a system of class power that has effectively fused together finance and government, and to propose a solution, the creation of a genuinely democratic culture. If it succeeds, it is likely to take a very long time, but the effects will be epochal.